Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
What's up, everybody, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm senior editor Devinder Hardwar.
I'm deputy editor Sherlyn Lowe.
Today, we are going to be diving into the TikTok divestment bill, which is a thing that President Biden has signed into law. We talked about it a couple of weeks ago, and honestly, we've talked about the U.S. government really pushing against TikTok for a while now. It feels like years this topic has been happening. So it has now reached a point where it has been signed into law. TikTok has 9 months to a year, depending on how the timing works out, to either sell the company or it will be banned. ByteDance basically has that timeline to sell the company or it'll be banned from American app stores. So that's what we'll be talking about with Carissa Bell, senior editor in Engadget. But before we get into that, folks, as always, if you're enjoying the show, please like and subscribe our channel. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. And also, yeah, subscribe to us on wherever you get podcasts. The Engadget podcast is right there. Okay, folks, let's talk about TikTok, and we are not going to be, like, this is going to be an ongoing story for a while. And joining us to dive into everything happening around TikTok and the new divestment bill is Carissa Bell, senior editor in Engadget. Hey, Carissa,
hey,
how's it going?
Why do I feel like I've been here before talking about this exact thing?
The same thing.
I feel deja vu. Oh, my God.
So we had Carissa on a couple of weeks ago to talk about when the TikTok bill passed the House, but this week it passed the Senate, and, like, immediately President Biden was like, okay, yeah, I'm going to sign that sucker. So he signed it immediately Wednesday morning. That bill is now law. It's a part of funding relief efforts that's going to Ukraine and other countries too. So it was, like, tied together. That's why it moved so quickly. But yeah, it's happening. Carissa, this is, can you just kind of recap what this means for TikTok and what we can expect from TikTok over the next year?
Yeah. So under the terms of the bill, they have basically up to about a year to sell off the U.S. portion of their business. And if they don't, then they'll be banned from app stores.
They is ByteDance.
Yeah, sorry, ByteDance, TikTok's parent company. Mm-hmm. And then if they don't, then TikTok will be banned from U.S. app stores, from web hosting services, basically will be, you know, completely, at least theoretically, inaccessible from within the United States.
Sounds like the reverse China firewall to me, or like used to be like Google can't operate in China. Now it's like Chinese can't operate in USA.
Yeah. Honestly, that is partially it. And that's partially also why I'm like, is that really the thing we want to copy? Like this sort of like wanton, just blocking of apps from other countries. So we talked about this in our previous episode. Like the reason this is happening is there are a lot of national security concerns about TikTok, about, you know, hey, every major Chinese company, the Chinese government has a hand in it, and has direct control over it. So there is a worry that TikTok could be used to disseminate, you know, messaging that's pro-China or that could destabilize the U.S. I saw some people also worry that, hey, TikTok could be tracking our user data and stuff. And as we discussed, if the Chinese government wanted user data, they can get it from data brokers. They could get it from so many different sources. What TikTok is collecting right now is not really that different than what Facebook or Google collects, like across all their services. So we talked about the need for a broader national privacy bill rather than just killing TikTok, but it looks like the TikTok thing is actually happening. I saw a really great breakdown at NBC. NBC News is reporting that basically we know TikTok has responded to this. They're saying it's unconstitutional. They're saying they're going to fight back. So that means court time. And that means this potential ban could be delayed for several years as TikTok goes back and forth in court. TikTok may fight it, and whoever wins or loses may even end up going to the or whoever loses could bring it back up to the Supreme Court, which would delay the ban even further. So nothing is happening immediately, but I do feel like it's sort of like if you're in a country and like the ground just shook beneath you, right? And you're like, can I keep building buildings here? Is this safe? I don't know if this is going to be around in a year or two. So that's why I'm thinking, like, the fun times we had with TikTok folks, where we could just enjoy the memes and the fun videos and the remixing videos and whatnot, that's over. Because now it seems like the guillotine is coming, and either it'll be sold off or it'll just die completely. Krista, from your perspective, do you think it could actually be sold to a major American tech company? Because I feel like regulators don't want more of that consolidation either.
I mean, maybe not an American tech company. There's an interesting story in the Information this morning saying that TikTok was looking at buyers that aren't tech companies. They didn't name names, but for example, you remember back in the Trump administration when Oracle was maybe going to buy it, Walmart was like going to be maybe involved. So, you know, you could, as weird as it is, you know, you could think of a company that potentially getting the mix. I mean, I think there's so many unanswered questions. You know, for example, it seems like the algorithm probably wouldn't be included in a sale because of Chinese trade laws. You know, that would be a major drawback for any buyer. But at the same time, I think if you're TikTok, you're probably still going to be looking at buyers. You know, you're not going to put all of your eggs into, you know, winning these court battles. Like they probably are going to be evaluating their options. It's just not really clear what those options are at this moment.
It's sort of like not quite as immediate, but like when Elon Musk bought Twitter, we were like, oh, well, this is all over. This whole like whatever fun we were having on Twitter is kind of all over. And now it's sort of like, well, ByteDance is going to probably try to sell off part of TikTok, although they say publicly that they want to fight it more. But even then, like, there are influencers right now who are making a lot of money from TikTok, right? They have based their lives around it. And I feel like a lot of them are going to start shoving back towards YouTube or other platforms or Instagram or wherever, because they don't know how long this is going to stick around. The weird thing is that President Biden's presidential campaign is still going to keep using TikTok. They're going to still keep using TikTok to reach out to younger voters. There's a quote from a Biden campaign official speaking to NBC saying, "A fragmented media environment requires us to show up and meet voters where they are, and that includes online." Sounds like a robot. "TikTok is one of many places we're making sure our content is being seen by voters." You guys are the ones trying to kill TikTok. I don't. Okay. Okay. Yeah, this also seems like a weird thing to do in an election year or two when the Biden campaign wants to court young voters, whereas now they're going to be like, "You're taking away my TikTok and you want me to vote for you?" That seems not so great. I don't know if you've heard anything, Carissa, about, like, I don't know, the broader reaction to TikTok potentially going away.
I mean, yeah, I think you kind of nailed it. It's, you know, for young people especially, it's kind of like, okay, you're going to take away TikTok, and not just you're taking away this thing I like, but then there's also all these other big problems that are not being solved. Yeah. You know, there was an interesting moment when this bill was kind of moving through Congress when TikTok sent out these notifications to users and telling them to call their Congress people and, you know, ask them to vote against the bill. And a lot of them did. And it was kind of funny because, you know, there's all these Hill staffers that were, you know, super upset because they said, "We're just getting all these calls from like confused teenagers.
They're calling our phones.
They don't understand what Congress is, but they're like calling us." And, you know, then they got all worked up and called it like interfering with the legislative process. But, you know, almost like, don't you want young people to be involved in knowing what's going on in the world and like being engaged? So I don't know. There's like a lot of hysteria, I think. Definitely a lot of young people are going to be very upset about this, you know, but at the same time, I think it's going to move so slowly. And like, if you're just like a TikTok creator, you're not going to notice a difference in the next few months, even up until election. I don't think you're not going to like see the app go away. You're not going to like see some big change. So it might be a bit of a delay before we actually kind of see that big reaction.
I'm kind of finding, I don't know if you, either of you are using TikTok differently than like YouTube Shorts or like Instagram. Like, is there like a purpose for when you jump to one of these sites? Because for me, when I'm just like so tired, I don't want to think about anything, TikTok is the perfect, like, just flip up and down the channels and get stuff thrown at me. Whereas if I'm in YouTube Shorts, occasionally I do that, but it's more, I'm actually getting useful information, like based on the YouTube channels I already follow. In Instagram or Facebook, it's more like, it's like worse TikTok. Like it's memes, it's like comedians and stuff like that, but it's never as good or entertaining as it is on TikTok. So I don't know. Have you all like cordoned off like how you use these apps at this point?
Instagram is definitely my like, I don't know, just turn off my brain and kind of not think. Yeah, it's like the Instagram reels. So just kind of like, like you said, like it's kind of like worse TikTok, but you know, kind of like.
Mm-hmm. I can see why Meta's mad. They're like, we want people to turn off their brains with us. Not with another yeah. app. We want to mindlessly send them ads. Okay, that's our job.
Yeah, like I definitely like don't feel wow. good after like a long scrolling session there. You know, but I still mm-hmm. keep coming back to it. TikTok is more like when I want to see something new and interesting, or if I'm like, you mm-hmm. know, want to actually like see things I haven't seen before, or like new memes or music is kind of like more go for TikTok when I'm actually like kind of
yeah.
looking to engage
yeah.
a bit more.
I've noticed that. I've also noticed live streams. I'm seeing live streams of news that's happening, you know, something that I have not seen reported anywhere. But I'm seeing live streams first on TikTok versus other services, whereas that used to be Twitter. It used to be like that's where I was mindlessly browsing and like, oh, big news is happening. For some reason, it's now TikTok. So I find that a little odd.
I don't know if I'm like contrarian here, but my
you don't like TikTok, Sherlyn. I think we know that.
Sure, but my doom scroll thing is Reddit, and that's how I go over to other places. So like, because on Reddit, there's less of a chance I'm going to encounter something I want to buy.
But this means this involves reading words, and sometimes I just want to get the content.
I'm more of like I want to read, and then like my two like time killers right now when I'm watching TV is either Reddit or I open the New York Times crossword. Not to be all intellectual on y'all, but wow. It's either those. And to Chris's point, like if I am looking for one of those like video first services, I go to Instagram, but not the Reels section. I go to the feed, but I just scroll and then like it's like low humor nation or like cats memes, and like it's just quick videos of those things, and I'm like, yes, these are so cute. I just laugh at like cats being cleaned, or not cats, dogs being cleaned or whatever. It's just cute. If I do go to TikTok, like to answer your question, Devendra, I am looking specifically for some creators I follow, like Adrian Bliss or Yuri, I forget her full name, does these Kardashian impressions. That's specifically, I'll just go and look for them. And then that's it. I don't want to go. Or I guess I go look at the Engadget TikTok every now and then. I'm like, what's
you're like,
Jess
okay,
up
okay,
to?
I'll do that. It's well, I'm just saying, like, it does feel like the end of a whatever era it was. Like, I remember when Vine just kind of died, and Vine was a cool thing of like cool experimental videos. I think TikTok, like, in many ways, say what you will about China, like being in charge of all of it too. The remixing of content that TikTok has basically produced, like the ability to take a video and then multiple times remix kind of at free will, is something like we have not seen too much when it comes to like higher level media. You know, reposting on Twitter is like close to it. Reblogging on Tumblr is kind of close to it. But yeah, TikTok achieved something special. I think that's a big part of the appeal. It's the algorithm, and also content is just like free to remix. And that there was something special there.
I'd be curious to see if they can pursue a way where they are selling the US arm of the business, but they still retain through a sort of partnership some input into that arm, and whether that will fly under the new thing.
They can keep a minority stake, is my understanding.
Yeah. That's what I would expect them to do. Because like you said, Carissa,
we've been talking
very
about
difficult to
The cyber war, Sherlyn. The cyber war, uh-huh. right? The like cold cyber war that's been happening. And that's still a thing. I think that's what the government is so worried about, right?
I guess. Yeah. Okay. So I see what you're saying.
That's
cold war, but cyber war.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. But I'm approaching it from like the business legality point of view, which is that there is still a way for, look, I'm thinking of my man, Cho. And having to explain where he's from in Asia again, and it's great. And his brain, where is he at? Is he going to, I mean, he's clearly not just a puppet, but quite, you know, like,
I mean,
not
kind,
full
kind
will
of.
Control. Yeah. That's what I'm thinking, right? So I don't think it's all up to him. But I do think that the approach, if we do lose TikTok in the US, what's next, I guess, was the question. And I don't know if it's like a separate app to take over all these hordes of people. I don't think it's ever going away. But like, I just looked to like how Temu just freaking appeared out of nowhere in in America. And Temu, to my knowledge, was never big in China before that. There is something afoot with that. And I'm like, A, the government has to go look at that next. But B, it wouldn't surprise me if like TikTok goes away and then just a whole new app called TalkTik just shows up. Like just to take over, you know? And I'm like, all right. So I find it very murky, and potentially there's a lot of ways for, if China is really insidiously manipulating things here, there's a lot of ways they're going to go about this. So
there is messaging being secretly sent to American kids that China is sucking up user data because they can get better user data from the data brokers that's selling all of our data, because our government has done nothing to protect private user data. The Chinese government and some of their hacker groups are attacking like U.S. infrastructure and other things. Like, things have happened that we directly link to China, like data being stolen from companies in the U.S. or there were specific hacks, I think, against infrastructure. And that's the thing where we're like, well, we're just kind of at a standstill, right? Like, this is happening. We hack them. They hack us. What do we do? What do you think about companies like DJI and the other Chinese companies are really big in the U.S. right now? Because it didn't work out so well for Huawei, right? They're gone. They're dead.
Huawei.
Yeah.
We used to cover them with such fervor, and then we just stopped. And
because they were...
It was for them. It was the... assisting the Chinese government in, you know, concentration camp type environments for people who are of Uyghur heritage, that really caused all of us to kind of just step back from covering them at all. And then moving from that, Huawei just, I don't think, ever recovered. Because then they lost access to Android and all of that stuff. So,
and also their executives, I think, were also basically closely tied to the Chinese government because of that too.
I was mildly threatened by one of them before. So really? It was weird.
Okay. Yeah. So anyway, there are all these other companies. Just bought that DJI stabilizer camera. I'm like, I hope they stick around for a while. But also, it is really weird that they are now like one of the world's top drone companies and camera companies, huh? I wonder what could happen with that data.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, Carissa, do you have any takeaways for us? Like, what are you looking towards next when it comes to this story? Are we waiting for TikTok to respond more, more aggressively? Like, are we waiting for them to do something?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see kind of how they approach this legal challenge. You know, when the app was banned in Montana, they didn't do the legal challenge directly. They funded a group of creators who were kind of challenging it. And they sort of funded it on their behalf. And that challenge was successful in Montana. It wasn't, that law was very different than this one that was just passed. But I think that kind of is a good, like, it kind of shows you how they might be thinking about this. I think this one is like so much more existential to them that I think that it's, that they might, you know, they're more likely to actually just go ahead and challenge it themselves. I think it's going to be interesting to see kind of what argument that they make. From what I've read, it seems that, you know, they do have a good First Amendment case, but on the other hand, the government saying, you know, waving their hands and saying national security, it kind of makes it could go either way, 50-50.
It seems like some politicians have seen things that aren't released to the public, too. Like, they have maybe seen some things happening and they can't tell us what's happening. So that's always weird. As a journalist, I want to know, what are you talking about?
Again,
right?
It's not really clear. And this is one of my biggest problems with this law, is that if, you know, if our government knows something concrete about what TikTok is doing that makes it an actual, like, really vital, like, security threat to this country, then I think that should be public. If you're going to be, you know, banning a service used by 170 million people here. There were these classified briefings that happened for Congress ahead of the votes. And it was kind of interesting because, you know, a lot of lawmakers walked out of these and they were like, wow, this was really scary. And, you know, they seemed like very convinced by what they heard. Like, they seemed to think it was very serious. And then there was a few others who said, well, it was mostly kind of hypothetical, you know, things that could happen, or, you know, they described a lot of things that could be true of any app. Any big social media service. So, and there was an effort, some lawmakers said, hey, they asked for some of this information to be declassified, which I think would be really beneficial. Like, let's put it all out there in the public record and, you know, so we can all kind of get a sense of like what's actually driving this. But, you know, to the point you said earlier, there right now there is no hard public evidence that, you know, TikTok has manipulated its algorithm in such a way to like promote Chinese interests, or, you know, has stolen, you know, large amounts of U.S. user data, you know, for some kind of like spying. There have been like a few isolated incidents, and then there's been a lot of like unsubstantiated allegations. But, you know, in terms of like what we actually know for a fact has happened, a lot of it is just kind of like people speculating about something, like something that could happen.
There was a story about a couple of TikTok employees like tracking user data, right? Like specifically looking up user background data, and like that sucks. But I think that you could probably find that at most big tech companies, like that sort of thing happens.
Yeah, there's a few journalists that were targeted. But you know, I mean, Uber famously did that. It's not a good thing. I don't think no one should be tracking journalists. But this was not like a large scale thing. It was, you know, a few people, and it's like, yeah, that's bad behavior. Did we ban Uber when they did that?
we should have punished Uber a lot more for a lot of things. Okay, we'll be keeping an eye on the story. Carissa, where can we find you on the internet these days?
I'm still on X, Carissa BE. I'm more often on Threads these days, hanging out there. Also on Blue Sky, same handle everywhere.
Thank you so much. And yeah, looking forward to chatting more about TikTok soon. Like hopefully something will actually change. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks, Carissa.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Okay, so let's have a bit of a fun and maybe contentious topic. This is something we brought up recently, I think in the last episode, but there's a lot of talk now about product reviews and what they mean, and I don't know what tech companies expect from them, what listeners and readers expect from them, and what the role of, like, you know, a site like Engadget and tech journalists are. I think it's worth talking about, just because I think people are so confused. I don't know if you've had this experience, Sherlyn, where you gave something a bad review, right? And then the company comes back at you, and instead of being like, oh, I'm sorry you had a bad experience, we're going to work on addressing these things, it's just whining. It's just whining about, you know, your response, like as if your review is a problem. I don't know if you experienced this with your Humane AI pin review, Sherlyn, but it seems like that's the big example. That thing was torn apart, and a lot of people at Humane and around that just can't seem to handle it.
I think we want to explicitly bring up again, because we did mention this before, that like, yeah, when Marquez or MKBHD's video went up, a lot of people, some people, I don't know if it was a lot, but were very vocal about the fact that like, he should not have been so harsh. You know, he will cause the downfalls of this company. And then Marquez had to like follow up and do a video about like what reviews kind of mean, or, you know, the idea that like reviews have to be fair and unbiased, not... And serve the reader and the audience. We're not here to serve the company. And I think that, to your point, in Humane's case, they haven't been like your typical angry company that like tries to get you to change what you say. And I think that that's the worst case, right? Like if a company is reaching out and in our emails and DMs saying like, you have to change your score, you know, this thing is wrong, you definitely did not burn yourself, that sort of thing. That's the worst thing they could do. But in Humane's case, it's been very much, I had nothing from my inbox, which is good. Mm-hmm. I don't want to hear from That's them good. In my inbox. Yeah. Humane's co-founder, Beth Buongiorno, has been pretty vocal on social media, responding to people and pretty active. I think some people had an issue with that. I actually didn't. I think what she's said so far publicly has been, it's really hard, right? Because you're reading words. You can't tell if they're yelling. You can't tell if they're angry. You can't tell if they're just chill and calm, right?
And I think she's been fine. Her responses have seemed fine. Yeah.
Exactly. My take is that Beth Bongiorno has sounded fine. My issue with this is less about the company's reaction, because generally I don't really care. At the end of the day, my responsibility is to the reader, to the audience. And it was shocking to me that it was the reader, the audience, the fans that were upset. And we've encountered this before. Every time I write a bad review of, say, a Surface product, or I call out something for being bad, you get people who are angry that you didn't use it right, or you're too dumb. Like, especially as a woman in tech, frequently the insult or the criticism of my reviews used to be, I think it's less so nowadays, maybe because of better moderation, used to be, you're too dumb. You just don't know how to use it correctly. You don't. And I'm like, I went to school for
That's not a good criticism against you, really.
We've talked about how, like, fans sometimes just enter these toxic relationships with the companies that they adore and don't even accept that these companies can be flawed. So that's really what got me to thinking about, like, yeah, let's think a bit more about what reviews, like, what the purpose is now, right? Like, what was it in the past before? Davinder, you've been covering tech a lot longer than I have. Well, a lot. Longer than I have.
A while. Well, since, like, 2010. Well, I know you were still doing college work, Sherlyn, and probably even earlier. I don't know. We're not going to date Sherlyn here. But I will say, I've encountered this early on. The thing about, I think, any journalist, a tech journalist or any kind, like, you have to realize you have a responsibility with your platform. So if you are irresponsibly, you know, tanking a product, or irresponsibly, like, ragging on a product unjustifiably, that could be a problem, you know, and that's just bad journalism. That's bad writing. That's bad criticism. I fully believe in the power of criticism in many, you know, aspects. Like, I'm also a film critic. I review TV shows as well. So I think anything that's created can be looked at through a really constructive and critical lens. And that's kind of how I do tech stuff. I will say the cheesy thing is, I like to think of Tron, right? Like, when I review things or when I cover things, like, I'm thinking, I'm fighting for the user here. And what I've learned is that sometimes even the user will get mad at you for pointing out things. So I think there was a company, there was Boxy, if you remember the Boxy box, it was a little streaming box. But, you know, there was a situation where they released a product that was terrible and they didn't send the reviews units out. So I bought one and I reviewed it as being a terrible product. And then, like, shortly after, the company fell apart. So I feel bad about that because I like the company. I liked the people involved and they were working on cool tech. But you can't like pretend, no matter how much goodwill people or the press have towards you. Like, if you produce something bad, I have to tell people it's bad. That's how it works. You don't want to have journalists or anybody, like, treating people differently just because you like them. And I think Humane tried to do that. They really tried to be buddy-buddy with a lot of media and things like that. Yeah. And I will say, even some people at Humane, I think, were really pissy about this whole thing. Like, I see people whining who work at Humane that, oh, man, this is just a first-gen product. These people don't get it. You know, like, we're working. We're going to build something great here. What really annoys me, though, is then I see the Twitter responses from people in the tech world or Silicon Valley or investors being like, you're killing it. You're doing great. Just keep it up. And I'm like, what? This is a failed product. This is, like, a failure of imagination and execution. And I can understand saying, like, hey, it's good you tried. But, man, the amount of, like, I don't know, the amount of, like, water carrying that people do for these companies is totally wild. So I just want to put that out there.
I think you make a good point. This is a failed product, but that I want to point out, a failed product does not a failed company make, right? I think that how they react and how they therefore re-strategize, regroup, will have a lot, you know, to do with the success of their company, whether it's a 1-year company, whether it's a 10-year company, whether it's longer than that. Like,
oh,
that,
this is not a 10-year company, Sherlyn. Like, we don't know. They have tens of millions in funding.
Well, if they pivot into something that's going to be, like, completely wildly different, we don't know. I can't predict it. But anyway, I wanted to also, like, you, as you were talking, you know, it brought up a lot of different, like, thoughts for me. Number one, in that, you know, you think there is a place for criticism. I do too. And to be clear, as reviewers, as writers, as reporters, we criticize each other internally too on the daily. Like, when I edit someone, it's
not, I make fun of Sherlyn all the time. Like, that's just how it goes.
Yeah. And, like, it's for improvement, right? Like, the people, when we, as editors, when we're editing our writers, you know, we can tell when someone's going to improve. It's when they're open to criticism, when they're able to, like, listen and take constructive, like, advice well. And Davinder's good about this, where, like, Davinder, you surprised me one time where you were like, oh my gosh, thank you for these, like, edits. They're very helpful. That approach is genuinely what's going to make you better as a person.
I've had
as
bad
a
editors,
writer,
is the thing. Is like I've had people be really annoying about how they edit, so I know the bad side of it too. Yeah.
Well, that's good to know. I don't even honestly, I've never thought about it that way. And then the other thing I wanted to say, and so yeah, so we're very familiar with being criticized. We understand that it can feel very like bruised on your ego, but it's for the better of your product. It ultimately, don't take it personal, and that's the best. Then the thing about the YouTubers and creators and influencers doing reviews versus reviewers at websites like Engadget, Wired, The Verge, and certain like influencers like, I think, Mr. Mobile, there's a difference in that we are not ever paid to do things. We're never paid to review a product. We have a lot of like editorial judgment independent of companies. And I think that the criticism lobbied at some people out there is that when they are paid to do a review or when they're paid to make a video of a product and then they come out critical about it, I can see why companies might feel a certain way. Do I think it's fair that they like, you know, pay a creator?
I also rarely see that, Sherlyn. Like, I rarely see a situation where the creator is paid.
Right.
And also they end up actually being critical of the product. So I don't know.
Exactly. Right. When you're paid, you frequently are positive.
I
want to
keep this money train coming, is the thing.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
I think in our tech space, we have some very like well-known names that are good at it about, you know, transparency, disclosure. So Mr. Mobile, I think Marquez is pretty good about it as well. Quite a few others. I think my issue is I've seen it happen outside of my space, outside of our space, tech industry. So I would see like fitness influencers be very suspicious about who they, you know, whether they disclose if a product was given to them, that sort of thing. It's quite interesting to see, and I can see why there is a lot of suspicion out there. But we have an ethics statement. We have a how we test that explains that we do receive products to test for free, but we treat that as a loan. We always make every good faith effort to return them at the end of the testing period. And also
we don't take trips, things like that.
We do not take paid trips. Our ethics page is very clear about like how and when if we ever need to accept like an Uber to an event, that sort of thing. Or like we happen to take a bus from CES's like lobby to the middle of nowhere to cover Qualcomm's like satellite thing. Sure, that sort of thing. But anyway, all that leads me to saying that we're updating some of these pages about how we test things. We're going to share a bit more about our testing process. How do we test laptops? How do we test smartphones?
Yeah.
That's coming very soon. Sorry, I didn't mean to like steamroll.
No. I think that's totally worth calling out. And also, people in the live chat, listeners, you know, drop us thoughts at podcastandgadget.com. Let us know what you think about how we review things, what you'd like to see. I would love to hear things. Like I come from an IT tech background, so I'm always thinking about like how do normal users, you know, how will they interact with these products? How will it be good for their lives? So that's like something I'm reviewing Dell's XPS 13 and 14 and 16 now, and like I have some issues. Even though they have pretty design elements, I have issues with like what this means for users, and it's still like in my craw, you know, like that's just the problem with these designs. So That's just how I'm rolling into things. But yeah, I'm glad we had this conversation. And folks, like sometimes we're going to be critical. It's okay. It's fine. Your companies will be totally fine.
It's not about you. It's about the product and being good. That's all.
Let's move on to other news. And we've got a bunch of stuff to talk about. I think one of the more interesting stories this week, Meta announced that it's opening up the Quest OS to third parties. And that includes Asus and Lenovo, who are going to be building new headsets. This gives me flashbacks to the Microsoft mixed reality headset things.
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah, it's HoloLens? That whole thing.
Oh, those other ones.
The other headsets that nobody really bought. But Asus says it's going to be working on a performance gaming headset. Lenovo, we're working on a productivity, learning, and entertainment headset. Don't forget the Lenovo also built the Oculus Rift S, which was a headset that came out, the slight upgrade over the Rift. It was not great. It was kind of terrible, honestly. But yeah, Lenovo had that deal too. So we're going to be seeing more things running the Quest OS. I think this is a good thing for the Quest platform because the whole lockdown thing where it was only Meta's hardware running Meta's software, unless you're Apple, right? Unless like you can do this on your own, I really don't think that's a good thing for an entirely new ecosystem of products, right? So opening up is better. I'm sure Microsoft is annoyed that they kind of stepped out of this market. What is weird is that there is going to be an Xbox-inspired Quest headset. I don't know what that means. Is it going to have Xbox colors? But that's happening. So Meta and Microsoft are working together on something. Kind of weird, too. I think this is good news for the VR industry because I've been talking about how it feels stagnant. This is good for Meta because having more people using their software should hopefully make their operating system better and their ecosystem more, just more interesting rather than just relying on their own headsets. And maybe this also means we won't see a new Meta Quest for a while because they're just letting people do a thing for a year, you know?
Yeah, do they really need to upgrade their hardware that much since the last one, Dev?
Not really. Like, the Quest 3 is really good. I don't know how well it's sold, but they could reduce the price, but also let these other companies come in and do slightly different spins on their platform. And I think that's probably a smart thing to do. So, yeah. It also, in other news, we saw that Apple has scheduled a virtual event for May 7th. I think we've all been waiting for this one. The imagery around it is a pen, a pencil, the stylus, and like coloring. So clearly iPad stuff. It's all the iPad upgrades we've been waiting for a while. Do you have any thoughts like on this, Sherlyn? We're going to do like a full preview soon. But yeah.
Yeah, we will. My whole thing is this. What is up with Maytember or May, whatever this is going? Like, come on. God. Google I.O. is May 14th. Microsoft Build is May 21st. But I didn't need, like, give me breathing space, Apple. This
ends, I think so this May is 7th, pretty normal. This, yeah.
I get it. We always have this, like, right after, like, in the middle of spring, we have a little bit of a, like, a bump, right? And so I guess it's good that they didn't choose the week of Google I.O., right? When we're all traveling. But
it's a virtual event. So it's like half a day.
Yeah, it's at least.
Deal with this.
Well,
it's. And then reviews. Yeah.
It's a virtual event. And then, yes, likely if they announce product, I technically know nothing. there will be reviews.
The signs all point to iPads. Yeah.
Right after. Right. And so, yeah. So that's work for us. And then also, like, you know, y'all know how I love to talk about inside scoops and behind the scenes stuff. And so, leading up and in May, there's a lot of like other stuff y'all don't know about that's also happening behind the scenes. And so you'll see by the end of May what I was referring to. But May is already shaping up to be a busy, busy month. I will say, yes, we've been looking forward to new iPads for a bit. I also wanted to point out that this week we also saw the rumor that Apple is overhauling the calculator app and going to like unveil a genre-defining calculator app at WWDC in June. And this is the calculator app for Mac computers. Mac OS 15, when that is presumably announced at WWDC, will turn the calculator app into a, quote, quoting our article, note-taking, currency-converting hybrid app. It will have... Right? I'm like, all right, I guess I could use a calculator to convert currency in a way that I wasn't before. The shapes of buttons will change. The functions on buttons that were numbers before will also change. There will be a history tape, so like a log, I guess, of previous calculations. You don't have to like note them down on a separate notepad if you're working with a lot of data. And then there will be a like an indicator bar showing you what mode it's in, whether it's like scientific mode or programmer mode or basic mode. And it will integrate into notes better as well. So yeah, I mean, are you hyped for a new calendar?
No, I'm not hyped for it. I found it really funny. This is Apple Insider. So like they love Apple stuff. Like this was a fun scoop for Apple Insider. But I'm like, okay, cool. New calculator, man. Let's move on. Let's move on to something else that's more interesting. Like,
I guess we've run out of ideas. I don't know. Honestly, like knowing Apple,
it has been updated for a while, so I get it. Yeah.
But who's looked at the calculator and thought, I need to update this thing, right? I don't know.
Give us a record. Like the record of calculations. I think that's helpful. So that's
coming.
That's
the history tape. Yeah.
Yeah. That alone is going to be useful.
I think WWDC is going to be interesting because isn't that where we also saw things like the journal app be first unveiled and like a lot of the mental health and things that are that came to watchOS and iOS, like, oh, log your emotion, that sort of thing. It's interesting for me to see what Apple is doing with this software because there's clearly not a lot of room left in hardware on phones to quote, innovate, I guess. So I think that I personally am interested to see what WWDC brings.
Gotcha. Cool. Well, I mean, yeah, that's a whole... Then we're prepping for DubDub after this event. Like, it never ends. We also saw the news. Hey, Amazon is launching an updated grocery delivery program. It's going to be $10 a month. on top of a Prime subscription, but it means free deliveries with a $35 minimum purchase, which kind of used to be the thing. You used to be able to get free deliveries with a Prime membership. So they're kind of bringing that back. This is a program that's going to be coming to 3,500 supported cities. Also cool that it's going to be working, I believe, with SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and EBT as well, right? So other ways that people can access groceries, especially with when they need a little help, like it's going to be cheaper for people who need to get that access. I believe it's $5 a month if you have, yeah, it's $5 a month if you have a registered EBT card. You get the Amazon Fresh and the Whole Foods deliveries, and also stuff from other stores too, like Cardenas Markets, Save Mart, Rite Aid, Pet Food Express. Rite Aid would be fun. That'd be a useful one. I know there's a lot of conversations around Amazon specifically, but grocery delivery in general. And I do feel guilty if I have to do an Instacart order, if I need something like immediately, like I tip well. I feel guilty that somebody has to run around the store and like get all this stuff. I don't know. How do you feel about it, Sherlyn? Like, have you used any of the grocery delivery stuff?
Yeah. I mean, I've been a very long time like Amazon Prime person, and I used to rely a little bit on Amazon Fresh, especially during the pandemic to get my groceries. And I got very annoyed when they removed the like 35 and above gets you free delivery situation. So I'm one of those people that sort of targets.
So would you pay this $10 a month to get that back?
No.
That seems like it would be worth it.
No, because I quite enjoy going to the grocery store myself nowadays. Like,
well, if you can walk to it, it's nice. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, it's a 20-minute walk for me, so it's not great. But I'll just walk. Like, yeah, it's you've been in my neighborhood, Devendra.
I've walked through. I met Sherlyn for coffee in her neighborhood, in unnamed city. But I do miss, like, when I was in Brooklyn, Sherlyn, I do miss, like, hey, the grocery store is like right there. So I'm walking back from the subway. I can just get stuff. I don't need to like stock up and do a whole big run. Whereas now, I live in the suburbs, and it's terrible, Sherlyn, because every time I go to the grocery store, I have to like load up a crap ton of stuff. It always is more expensive than you think, and then you have to like store the stuff everywhere. I kind of do miss having limited space, because it's like, okay, well, I'm not going to buy too much, because
you're going to be a hoarder.
I can only fit so much in my Brooklyn kitchen and refrigerator and everything. But anyway, I think this is it's a cool program. Hopefully the workers are being paid well, like $10 a month to get this stuff. I hope anybody who does this tips well. Like, that's the ultimate thing, I hope. I see Instacart shoppers like running around the store trying to be fast and stuff, and I feel really bad for them sometimes.
I also, I follow the subreddits of Instacart and DoorDash and all of those services. And like you, Devendra, you said just now that you feel a bit bad. I do feel bad. Like, one time I mentioned something else. I was dealing with a delivery thing in Slack, and Devendra was like, I said, dealing with delivery shit or something. And then you said, why do you get shit delivered? And I actually thought you were coming for me. Like, that's how guilty I feel about getting stuff delivered. I thought it was just like...
Yeah, why were you getting literal shit? Yeah.
It was like an actual joke. And I was like, oh, he was joking. I thought like... And that's because I judge myself, right? And so like, yes, of course I try to tip more too. But like, I also am with the people who agree that like, it's very expensive to get stuff delivered anymore nowadays. And it's a lot of fees, but is it all going to the delivery people, the delivery workers? Like, we want to make sure it's paying the right people and not lining the pockets of billionaires.
I mean, I think a lot of companies say tips go straight to the workers. Something people do is also, I've seen people just give, if you are there and you see the person, you could just give them cash for a cash tip. That's also a good thing. It's just, I can't always like meet the delivery person.
I don't have a lot of cash. Yeah.
Anyway, we'll keep an eye on all this stuff. Sherlyn, did you want to talk about this thing? This other story about the world's leading AI companies pledging to protect the safety of children online. This seems all very obvious. OpenAI, Microsoft, Google, Meta. Everybody is promising to stop their AI tools from generating and spreading content containing child sexual abuse materials. What else are they going to say? Yes, we don't want this to happen, right? Is this a surprise? I don't know.
Right. It's kind of like, duh. Like, of course you didn't. Like, of course. So basically the news is that like companies, including OpenAI, Microsoft, Google, Meta, and others have jointly pledged to prevent their AI tools from being used to exploit children and generate the child sexual abuse material, or CSAM. And the initiative was led by a child safety group called Thorn, as well as a nonprofit focused on responsible tech called All Tech is Human. And it's kind of like, good. At least we started somewhere, right, on this ethical AI use.
I mean, there's already like terrible uses. There's people using like what is it? I think in high schools, right? Some kids were found to be using it to make the girls in their high schools appear naked, and that's gross and terrible. But these tools exist.
It's absolutely awful.
That's what they.
It's absolutely awful. Yeah. And the problem is this: like the that story about the high school kids using AI to generate those, you know, fake nudes. I mean, we've seen the episode where, you know, Ross was, you know, photoshopping images of Chandler onto like some pictures
who
of gay porn.
About?
Like,
are you making
I'm talking
a
about
Friends reference
now.
Right now, Sherlyn?
I made a Friends reference because that's how old I am. But look, as long as some of these editing tools have been available, we've, you know, come around. We've wrestled with these same questions of ethics.
It's just
and
so easy
use.
Now. Like, that's the danger.
It's getting even easier now. Like, to look realistic, to look believable. So, yes, it's high time. It's been high time for a while. It's like peak time, higher time, higher than peak time to talk about how to use AI, how to like clearly label AI edited work and in a way that can't easily be cropped out. I don't know. It's very complicated, but I'm glad we're starting somewhere.
Awesome. Awesome. We have a bunch of other stories. There was new stuff around the Ray-Ban's Meta smart glasses. They are adding multimodal AI, which means that they can see images now, like they can give you a little more information about things. Also, they showed off like a couple new designs for these things. Sherlyn, you just came out of the hell of reviewing the Humane AI pin. Do you think the idea of, you know, Meta smart glasses becoming smarter with AI capabilities, is that more useful to you than the pin?
Yes and no. I honestly would have to try it out to tell you for certain, but I have tried the Ray-Ban Meta glasses, and I can tell you at least they don't like burn my face. You know what I mean? Like they sit there. The camera is a little bit better. You can at least kind of, it's your vantage point. It's a wider angle. It's going to sit level on your face, hopefully, because you should usually have, you know, your ears are usually level. Uh-huh. Whereas the Humane AI pin's almost always askew. So it's like, all right, we'll see. I know there's a lot. I don't know that there's a direct comparison between the Ray-Ban Meta and the Humane AI pin. But I would say that the Meta glasses, at least if they're dead, they still serve as like sunglasses. So
they still work. But yeah, you can also do more interesting things with them, right? Like you can get audio type straight to your ears. You could listen to podcasts without having headphones on. You could take pictures and photos and then maybe occasionally get information about stuff you're looking at. So that's
right.
I've not tested this. I know Chrisabelle actually has done some of this testing. She wrote about it, I think, last month or recently. So you could go check out her piece. I will say this seems a lot more functional than the AI pin. Like this is something people may actually want. It seems like one of those things like it's aspirational in a way. Like, sure, I want glasses that can take pictures and do all sorts of cool stuff. Whereas I don't know how many people are dreaming of having a pin on their chest to do AI stuff other than the Star Trek nerds. You know, I think that's what that product was ultimately made for.
Speaking of the Humane AI pin, and I think we'll quickly get to this, but yeah, there's been a lot of like hype around AI centric devices, like the Ray-Ban Meta's new features. We did see that Rabbit launched its Rabbit R1 this week. I attended the pickup party,
yes.
And I'll get to it in a little bit, but you know, I have thoughts and stay tuned.
Awesome. Awesome. Let's clear out. We've got a couple of other things. Briefly want to mention, we have a piece on the rebuilt Sonos app. So if you have Sonos speakers, it seems like it's getting a new app that looks a lot nicer. It has like a customizable home screen. You could link directly to your services or things you've recently played. I like Sonos speakers a lot. I think they sound great. But and for the cost, like they actually work pretty well. But man, their app is a pain. Like it is buggy. It is kind of confusing. Like there's so many tabs and things to go through. This looks a lot cleaner. This looks like the app Sonos should have had years ago, to be honest. So, okay, I'm glad they're getting the software right at some point. And also, we saw the news that X announced it's going to have a smart TV app. So, okay, Twitter on your TV, Sherlyn. Yes. Yes? No? Maybe so?
Okay, so when I first saw this, I have to admit, I thought they were launching their own TV streaming service. I was like, what? But, okay, X on my TV? For what?
What the kids want. This is what all the kids are asking for. They want X live streams and X.
They did,
Are people still doing video chats? Whatever.
They have some live TV. Yeah, live content, right? They do have like live.
They do, yeah.
They used to have good live coverage of like breaking news events.
You could watch the Tucker Carlson interview of Vladimir Putin. That's the first image on the ad for XTV. So that's where we're at right now. Good luck. Good luck with that. Also, do you want to bet if this thing even actually launches? Like, I can't trust X to do anything at this point.
I don't think it will launch. I don't know if I want to bet, but I don't think it'll launch.
Don't think it'll launch. Okay, let's move on to what we're working on. As I mentioned, I'm working on the XPS 13 and 14 reviews. Had a bit of a hiccup there because I know some weird trackpad issues. So trying to get that cleared out. I also have the new Surfaces. I'll be working on the best laptop guide for us as well. So fun stuff. Also looking forward to spending time with the Rabbit R1, Trillin, which I know you had time
with. Oh my goodness. Yeah, I just got a shipping notification that I had to tell you about.
So, oh, okay, cool, cool.
Yeah, stick around. Like I said, went to the Rabbit R1 pickup party, and I was big sad. I was so sad because
well, I had to be like, it's an 8 p.m. event, too.
Huh?
It's an 8 p.m. event. You have to go to late events.
Yeah, it started at 8 p.m. Eastern. It was at JFK, right? Because it was at
JFK?
Yeah, it was at the TWA hotel. So all the way at JFK Airport.
Oh, my God.
So the travel alone is like 2 hours. Oh, my God. Yeah. And then traveling after the event, which ended at like, it didn't even end until like 9:30 at the earliest, right? So like,
were they thinking like, everybody loves to go to the airport. Everybody would love to do the trek out to the end of Queens.
I gotta tell you, the TWA hotel is really cool.
Yeah.
And it really matches the whole Rabbit R1 like and Teenage Engineering retro vibe, right? It's very like retro cool 90s. And then, you know, walking into the event, they had little glass display cases of old gadgets, like a Game Boy Color, like a Watchman, not even a Walkman, a Watchman. There was a Pokédex, yeah. A pager.
They're really calling their shot in terms of how memorable the Rabbit R1 is going to be. So.
Okay. They're like, we're going to be in this Hall of Fame. I don't know. So I was sad because when I got there and it was like, transparency, right? We pre-ordered it ourselves. So we used our own company money to buy a unit. And because they are not actually shipping review units to anyone. So everyone that's going to review this has to like shell out their own money. And that's fine. But because of that, it was like, there was a bit of miscommunication over like whether I was picking up a unit at the event or having ours shipped to you, Devendra, which I had already said quite a while ago that it was supposed to be to you. So even though there was the option, they were like, do you want to just pick it up now? And then, you know, you can play with it and then ship it off to Devendra. I was like, I think it's smarter to just send it right to you. Like, it's just so much faster than me, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway. But so because of that, I didn't have a unit to play with at the event, and everyone was opening up theirs, and I was looking on, and it was so cute. So Max Weinbach very kindly let me like play with this because he had unboxed his faster than anyone else. I think because everyone else was like, I'm going home to shoot an unboxing video. Max was like, screw that, I'm opening mine. So we were playing around. It is so cute. It's so cute. It looks adore it.
It looks like they really took that play date. Yeah, the scroll wheel, but it's the same basic shape and color of the playdate almost. Yes. Well, playdate is yellow.
It's a little bit bigger, I think, than the playdate, and it's orange instead of yellow.
Similarly cute, I would say. Yeah,
very cute. The screen looks great. I mean, you could see like things on it than compared to the projector. And it's also like $200. I could buy one, like Mark Dell on our live stream mentioned, like he's already bought one. I'm like, $200? I could not eat for
a week. Guys, there's so many better things to do with your money.
I mean, the travel to the TWA hotel alone was already like $200 basically, so might as well. But okay.
Okay.
I will point out that this Rabbit R1 launch event, you know, in my hands-on for Engadget.com, which you can go read for more details, I already talked about how the CEO and founder of Rabbit, Jesse Liu, had made a lot of veiled comments about the Humane AI Pin, saying things like, we don't require a separate subscription fee. We have a screen, you know, we do all these things. And to be clear, it's very impressive that Rabbit's LAM, it's calling its LAM the large action model, is able to work with third-party apps like DoorDash or Uber or Spotify. You know, they basically act almost as an emulator and you know, will convert all these things to work with their language model.
You know what can also let me work with those things, Sherlyn? Is the phone that's in my pocket.
I get it. I'm so excited for your review, Devin. I will also say this. It was very impressive to see that there is this thing called Teach Mode on the Rabbit R1, which I don't know if it's going to be ready at time of like our review, but you're going to be able to like basically show the Rabbit R1 to do what you want it to do. And basically you're recording a macro.
Yeah.
In the way you would record a macro on a PC, you would just record a macro on the rabbit, and then it will learn over time to do what it is you want to do that it couldn't do before.
That's the coolest aspect of this product, if it actually works. This is one of those pie in the sky sort of like features, you know?
Yeah. I gotta say, I'm already hearing that it doesn't work very well.
I mean, of course, of course.
I feel so bad for cackling. I just was like,
you can't trust these companies. I'm sorry. Yeah.
I was so taken. I was like, so cute. The screen's great. The wheel's great. Like, the camera flips. It's awesome. And then people are like, the camera won't even work. Like, Chris Velasco over the Washington Post received his unit, and it was like, he was like, I can't even get it to recognize the camera. It won't even open to scan a barcode. You know, like, it's just, wow. So,
oh boy.
Enjoy. I'm so excited for you to review this Dimitra.
I am, listen, I try to approach every new product with like a sense of like wonder and whatnot, but after the Humane AI pin, I'm so skeptical of any piece of AI hardware, but we'll see, folks. Stay tuned for more coverage on all that stuff. Let's chat about what's happening around in gadgets. Sam had something about the new Qualcomm chips coming to laptops. That's cool.
Yes.
The X-Elite.
Yeah, I don't know if people are hype about it, but I guess the ARM.
No, nobody's hype about this.
Yeah, I know. Like, the ARM-based PC train is just not going to keep going.
I feel so bad because I could tell, like, Microsoft is out here and Qualcomm are like, guys, yo, Snapdragon laptops, finally, we did it. It's a thing. Don't worry about Apple's M1 and M2 and M3 chips. 3 years down the line, actually, almost four now. Yeah, we did it. We'll see. We'll see what happens with any of this.
I know.
So the big story this year is Qualcomm is saying, and benchmarks are saying, that the new Snapdragon chips are going to be pretty fast, like basically M series level speeds, you know, in Windows laptops. Are you excited, Trillin? Like, we're gonna see better ARM chips in Windows laptops. That's something.
You've said this before in a previous episode, and I think I will wait till build to see if Microsoft is going to show us how it intends to improve the software and the emulator layer in between to make ARM Windows 11
work well on ARM. I have so many
questions. I have so many questions around that. I have to think they revamped it from like system architecture level. Like, it has to be like so far down. They have to have reworked so much for it to even have a chance at working, you know? So we'll see.
I think Microsoft may be mad at me because when they launched the Surface Pro 9 with 5G, I was like, this is... You can't call it a Surface Pro 9 because it's not as fast as the Intel chip. Right. It is not pro in any level. Like, it was not something you would recommend to professionals at any level. I did not like that thing. I felt like Microsoft was lying to users. So I hope they're not lying to users again with these new chips. We've got a couple of pieces from Tim Stevens, the new Mercedes-Benz quad motor G-Class. They're like big, I don't know what you call this, like the all-terrain
vehicles. This is an EV off-roader, basically, right? Like a G-Wagon or like, it's a big deal. It's like, I think it's been long awaited for Mercedes-Benz to do this.
This seems like the world's least efficient electric car.
It's like, wow. Like, why? It's like, I want to go off-road in an electric vehicle. I don't know. I guess that could work, right?
You could do it with that would be a lot of fun. You could do it in the Rivians. It's just that Mercedes, the G-Wagon is that big boxy thing you see driving around, which costs a crap ton of money. And now it's that whole thing again, but it's going to be heavier because it's an EV. So it's not going to be great at actually being an off-road vehicle. Okay, sure. We'll see.
But check out the video. I'll say this. Check out the video that Tim made. It's on Engadget's YouTube channel. It's a fun one.
Okay. Always good to see Tim in our videos, too. Let's move on to our pop culture picks for the week. What do you got, Sherwin?
I think you'll enjoy this suggestion, but before I give you my actual recommendation, I finally watched Her. I did post about it on Threads.
Good. Yep.
Finally, and I just found it so funny that there was a flip phone as the main device. And this movie was, 10 years old at this point? Very cool. By flip phone, I mean a la the Samsung Galaxy Z Flip, not like an old, you know, Razer flip with no bendable screen. Anyway.
I mean, there was a lot of cool, like, how prescient that movie was, you know? I think.
Yeah.
Did you notice that even like the style and the fashion of the people in that movie, Sherlin? There's no jeans, right? People were wearing like soft clothing, like really chill, smooth clothing. And it's sort of like now everybody is just totally into athleisure, but also jeans are like less, we just want soft pants. We want soft pants and shirts instead of jeans now. So it's a whole thing.
Yeah.
The movie predicted it 10 years ago. Yeah.
Right. I didn't realize, you know, because again, I didn't have the like experience of watching it in 10 years ago where maybe styles and fashion were a bit different. I just felt like everything fit in. Everything felt very normal. I'm sure at that time.
When it feels normal now. Was, yeah.
Yeah, right, exactly. I'm sure at the time when the movie was released, it felt futuristic. And now to me, I'm just like, oh, yeah, it's set in modern day today. Yeah, okay. Anyway, that's not like my recommendation because it's old. I did get a chance this weekend to watch in the theaters Monkey Man.
Monkey Man's so good.
And
yeah.
Holy crap, Dev Patel. You're amazing. Dev Patel is like so skilled at this craft at this point. It was, I know there was going to be a lot of inevitable comparisons to John Wick, but Dev Patel's take and Monkey Man as a story has a lot more layers to it, in my opinion. It's not just about this man out for revenge, which is a very core part of the story. But there's like obviously the political side of it. There's the there's a bit of commentary on ostracization of marginalized communities and that sort of thing. And like I found that spoke to me. It was very like heartwarming to see some of it. And there's like a spiritual religious component, of course, as well.
There is. There's a lot of commentary about how like potentially dangerous that is too, because it's dealing with the spiritual component that is now driving like, you know, Hindu nationalism in India too, which is a big problem.
And it's very tied to the politics of it too. Yeah.
It is. I don't think it's even getting released in India now, because like there were some critics early on who were like, oh, what it's saying, it's trying to say something about India today, but it's not quite directly saying it. And people were calling it like half-hearted, but now like, it's, yeah, the Indian government does not want it shown in theaters. So I guess clearly that was enough. A little bit of criticism was enough. Yeah, I like Monkey Man. I like clearly Dev Patel loves action movies. Like there's a lot of great fight sequences.
Yes.
A lot of great, really cool stuff. Yeah.
I love when like there are actors from, you know, countries outside of America that make it big in Hollywood and then they go back to their home countries, they make a film and they take it as an opportunity to elevate the craft in their country.
India's like, not his home country, by the way.
Dev not Patel that it's
is,
his home.
Yeah,
I,
he's English.
Yeah, I didn't mean to insinuate that. Yeah. I just meant like, I see a lot of Bollywood, not the dance sequences, but I found like there was a lot of like good acting, really good like sturdy performances across the board. The action sequences were awesome. The boss figure was so great. I was just like, wow. I was just blown away.
Very well done. I cannot wait to see what he makes next. And I'm glad it made it to theaters and not like wasn't just reserved for Netflix or something. So I'm shout out to Jordan Peele for helping to save that movie from a streaming release only. It deserves to be seen in theaters. Yeah, go check out Monkey Man. Totally great. I want to shout out Shogun, which just ended and is a perfect TV show. Like, I have no notes for this thing. It is a great limited series. It's based on the novel, which was also a TV series like way back when. But I think it's a really well-done story. Sherlyn, I think you will enjoy it too.
I've been trying to start watching it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is based on the novel by an English author. And you would think, like, there is a white English character who is, like, the centerpiece early on and you think would be the center of the show, but he's not. Because the show is ultimately about, like, the politics of everybody involved, specifically Hiroyuki Sanada, the women also involved in the story. I think it's just really compelling. I think you'll enjoy the story. It's very much on the level of Game of Thrones when it comes to political intrigue, but it's also really well done. And the finale was like, it went out in a way I didn't expect. Like there's a quiet, meditative tone to the series too, even though it's a thing where you will also see people get beheaded and blown apart by cannons.
Yeah, I've heard.
Like, listen, katanas remove heads pretty quickly. So you do see that in the show. It's really cool. I think Shogun is a complete home run. It's on Hulu right now, and everybody should check it out.
Well, that's it for the episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter, Mastodon, Blue Sky, wherever, and I podcast about movies and TV at The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
If you want to send me some of the dankest and funniest TikTok videos while it still exists, you can hit me up. Strangely not on TikTok, I am at Sherlynlow on Twitter/X or at Sherlinstagram on Threads. Email us your thoughts at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And subscribe wherever you can get podcasts.